County, Pennsylvania, was unknown to paranormal enthusiasts until the Kevin Paul Amazon bestseller, Haunted Hills and Hollows, What Lurks in Greene County, Pennsylvania, revealed the phenomena lurking in and the haunted history of the southwestern corner of the Keystone State. Even more high strangeness can be found in Book 2 of the series, Kevin Paul's Haunted Hills and Hollows 2, still lurking in Greene County, Pennsylvania. One thing is certain, it is nearly impossible to be alone in Greene County. These riveting books, Haunted Hills and Hollows and Haunted Hills and Hollows 2, by author Kevin Paul, in paperback, Kindle, and audiobooks, are available now on Amazon. Longtime UFO and Bigfoot researcher Stan Gordon is releasing his fourth casebook called Creepy Cryptids and Strange UFO Encounters of Pennsylvania. Included are many cases from across his decades of research, from Bigfoot to giant flying creatures, mini UFOs, aquatic beasts, to hairless, sickly-looking humanoids. Enjoy a journey into a realm that suggests that present-day sightings of monsters might be real, mystifying creatures, none of which are supposed to exist. Some cases include one of the creepiest crawling cryptids of all time. Was there an even stranger Mothman encounter near Pittsburgh in 1966? The small Bigfoot and the strange sphere of light. Tall, hairless humanoid with glowing yellow eyes that follows man to his house. Stan presents some startling cases that suggest that some of the unknown creatures being reported may be much stranger than just flesh and blood. Could some UFOs, and even some cryptids, possibly be visitors from another dimension? Order your copy now of Creepy Cryptids and Strange UFO Encounters of Pennsylvania. Stan's new book, as well as his other casebooks, are available online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, or visit his website at www.stangordon.info. Do you remember how great paranormal talk radio was in the 80s and 90s? Night Dreams Talk Radio brings back to you talk radio like you remember, with your host, Gary Anderson, broadcasting to you live from his secret compound deep in the great Northwest. Now, here's Gary.
And here I am. Well, here it is, the 30th, just one more day of the month. And boy, then we're going to go into April Fool's Day, when another asteroid's going to go past the Earth on April Fool's Day. Well, again, it's coming out more from NASA about this big mass. It came from the sun, a solar flare. Actually, 17 are on the way. They're traveling at, ready for this, 2 million miles per hour. That is scary. And again, they're telling people, well, the internet, your TV and all radio could be affected. And some of the weaker power grids can go maybe down tomorrow. So be prepared for something tomorrow. If not, you might see some strange colors in the sky. Also in the news, the Loch Ness Monster has been spotted for the first time this year, according to an expert who's been studying the Loch Ness Monster. Again, you know, there's all kinds of theories what this could be, a huge eel, because that lake does have huge eels. But again, there's a big difference between something that looks prehistoric and maybe a 17-foot eel. So I don't know on that one. Well, if you could live at least 150 years, would you? Well, there's a catch to it. You would have to have your brain, all your thoughts, all your emotions downloaded into a computer, and you'd be, well, on the multiverse. I don't know if I would like that. Not to have the touch and feel. But then again, James, think about this. You wouldn't know what was real or not, would you? Because it would be like a hologram, a symbolization of things out there. I don't think if your brain was downloaded into it, you could even comprehend what's going on.
No, you raise good points. Matter of fact, that really would be like living in the Matrix to the max. I mean, I don't even know if you could handle that. Like, download your memories and just live on in the machine. So to speak, that whole aspect is just scary. I don't want it. You can have it.
What is that, though? That's not life that we are accustomed to. So, you know, yeah, they can maybe keep your thoughts and your brain thoughts at least 150 years. But again, you know, how can I say it? Are you going to fall in love with another download of another brain thoughts? I don't know. I just, the whole thought of it just kind of turns me off. Bruce Willis, He has been, for the last couple of years, and some of his movies he's been making, he's been having a hard time remembering his lines. Now it's come out today that he has totally quit acting. He has a disease that affects, well, communication, being able to talk, put words together, and even understand words. And that is a big hit because I'll tell you what, I like Bruce Willis, and he's made some really awesome movies. So, I mean, again, my heart goes out to him and his family. James, I mean, that is a big shock today.
It is a big shock. And, you know, I just, it's funny you mention that because I just seen one of his latest movies and he honestly did seem kind of off. And I never knew about this, but I bet that's what was going on. But, and he didn't have very much, a very big part throughout the movie either. And he was supposed to be a co-star. So I see where it all kind of comes together. But boy, that would be a shock. He's made a lot of good movies. Pulp Fiction was the one that sticks out to me.
Oh, yeah. Pulp Fiction. You know, again, too, they said that in the last two movies he made, actually, when you see Bruce Willis on there, most of the time it wasn't Bruce Willis, it was a body double, that he was even having trouble doing his, you know, physical things too. And they even tried putting headphones into his ear, you know, giving him his lines, but it got to a point that he couldn't put words together anymore. And that is what happens when you get older. It can be anything from a stroke, dementia, or, you know, like they just don't know what happens, but it really happens with older people and it comes on really fast. One day you're talking normal, the next day you're having trouble putting words together. That's scary. Well, in the UK, a security camera catches a creepy haunted doll that is moving on its own. Now, you know a bit stuff about like that. What could cause something like that?
Well, I'll tell you, it could be a few things, but it sounds like there's a spirit attached to it. And listen, dolls are already creepy, Gary, really. So you get a spirit attached to them, that's just putting gas on the fire. I've seen these things, and no, thank you. You can have them. Nope. Nope. Mm-mm.
Okay, well, I mean, what can you do to stop it if you have a doll that it's all of a sudden, you know, doing and moving and... You know, that'd be really creepy here in your room at night and you have a doll there on the headboard and it's watching you.
Yeah, they watch you, all right. But you can hermetically seal those. There's different ways, but you can seal them in glass with around salt and some other words and other trinkets. You can put around them, keep them sealed and keep them calmed down. There's different things along those lines. I mean, I think the Warren's got a whole bunch of those in their basement, matter of fact, and that's what they do, basically.
Yeah, well, a 500-pound bear in Arkansas got busted by the police. He set the alarms off at a local tavern, which was closed for the night. The bear was caught drinking beer, and he was under 21.
Gary, you cracked me. You know what that reminds me of? That reminds me of that story where the cop pulled over the horse for driving and drinking or something. But there we go again, these bears. How many stories have we come across in the last 3 or 4 years? These bears are encroaching, and well, they're drinking. Now they're drinking underage, allegedly.
Yeah, well, yeah. Can you imagine, you, how do you arrest a 500-pound bear? Come on. But the whole point is, you know, maybe there's a bunch of alcoholic bears running around.
There's got to be, with all the stories we've come across that come across the news line there about these bears. There's something about beer and bears. They just go together and they just love it. And now, well, I guess they go on the highways too.
Yeah, that's the interesting part. God, now I'm thirsty for a beer. Anyway, I have to tell everybody out there, I'm going to have to take a few days off. I should be back Monday. I have to have some medical stuff done. And I'm not going to be around for a few days while I get this stuff done. And we will try to get some replays on tomorrow and Friday. But, you know, gee, I hate going into the doctors and hospitals and stuff like that. Well, we'll be right back with our great guests. So get ready. Get yourself up on that easy chair. Put a log in that fire. Pour yourself something warm to drink. We're going to talk about D.B. Cooper tonight. Yeah. The guy who, well, hijacked a 727 and jumped out of the back of it. So we'll be talking about that. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
take a journey of adventure and discovery for the enigmatic giants of the forests. Read On the Trail of Bigfoot by Mike Dupler. The author himself describes it this way.
Having found possible Sasquatch evidence, namely trees driven into the ground upside down, thought to be territory markers, led me to investigate this creature in my native Ohio. Several years and many forays into Bigfoot territory, I have found incredible evidence, which inspired my book, On the Trail of Bigfoot. Bigfoot is alive and has many fantastic abilities. The evidence is out there for all to see, but you need to know what to look for. My book will inspire those who have answered the call to seek this elusive creature, the Bigfoot. The truth is out there.
Read On the Trail of Bigfoot by Mike Dupler. Available now at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and IndieBound.org.
Hi, this is Val Von Torn of Metatron Power and Light. You're listening to Gary Anderson and Night Dreams Talk Radio.
And you sure are. And thank you, Val, for that nice, nice intro to the show. James, what can you tell the listeners about our guest tonight?
Well, our guest tonight is Drew Beeson, and Drew is an author of three true crime books, including The Zodiac Killer and The D.B. Cooper Mystery, which he will be discussing tonight. Now, Drew can be heard on the True Crime YouTube channel and a few others as well.
Welcome to the show, Drew. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing great. How are you, Gary?
I'm alive, and that's better than the other. I'm still wondering if I should think about, when I get older, to have my thoughts and all my memories and everything downloaded on the computer. But, boy, I don't know if it'd be X-rated or R-rated.
I'm with James on that one. I'll pass.
Thank you. Well, I got to ask you a question. What got you into investigating crime cases?
I just always had a thirst for more knowledge of some of these classic unsolved American crimes, like the Zodiac Killer case and D.B. Cooper, two that I consider probably in the top five of just classic American unsolved cases. I love the mystery of it. You know, who was this person and why have they never been found? And I just wanted to dig in as much as I could. And for my own self, I just want to know who these people were. I love a good mystery, but I don't want it to go on forever. I want to get some resolution while I'm still alive of solving some of these classic crimes.
The Zodiac Killer, how much time did you spend on that one investigating it?
Off and on for about 3 years, about the same as D.B. Cooper. Got into it, watched some documentaries, and then just really started doing some hardcore research. I mean, it's not my full-time job, but it's a definite hobby that I'm passionate about, and I'll put as much time into it as I can.
How did the Zodiac Killer, how did they ever narrow it down?
It's never really been narrowed down. There's still a prime suspect in the case, a gentleman named Arthur Lee Allen, who a movie about the Zodiac is mostly about, based on a book by a guy named Robert Graysmith, and he remains the top suspect to this day, the prime suspect in the Zodiac Killer case, but he's never been completely proven to be the Zodiac Killer. There's just a lot of solid circumstantial evidence going for him.
Very, very interesting. Well, maybe someday with our technology advancing in DNA and all that stuff, maybe they can actually pinpoint who did it.
That's the hope. What they have in the Zodiac Killer case is a lot of written correspondence. So the hope is that they can extract DNA from one of the flaps of the letters that he sent or beneath a postage stamp that he sent. They thought they got a DNA profile from a letter that he sent in 1969, but it later turned out that the sample came from outside of the stamp and it wasn't really handled that well. And it's a really weak DNA sample. So it's unfortunately not a good DNA sample, which is something that they did have in the Golden State Killer case, where they were able to use DNA familial ancestry background search to narrow down who it could have been. And that's how they led to the arrest of Joe DeAngelo as the Golden State Killer, because they had such good DNA left at the crime scenes and were able to use that technology and the method of these DNA databases where they can go in and see, okay, this person's related to this person, and then they just start narrowing down by geography. They know that we found someone that's probably maybe a distant relative or a third cousin, and then they can, you know, they kind of know the age of who they're looking for, and that's how they finally zeroed in on Joe DeAngelo, and we're able to solve that long time cold case of the Golden State Killer. So I'm not as optimistic in the Zodiac case because we just don't have that really good DNA sample to start with like they did in the Golden State case.
How long does DNA last? I mean, you know, if it's not stored right or however they store it, is that something that could last forever or does it break down with age?
It absolutely breaks down with age as far as how good the samples can be. And, you know, the technology is getting better. Now they have what's called touch DNA where they can take smaller samples and make a full genetic profile out of those. Some of these labs like Parabon and there's another one near me in Texas. It's doing some really fantastic work and closing a lot of cold cases with this new DNA technology. But unfortunately, it does get old. It does degrade if it wasn't stored right. And, you know, so that is a challenge. But, you know, it's technology versus the age of the DNA is kind of a thing we have going on now.
Very interesting. Now, moving on to D.B. Cooper, did they ever at that time, did they even think about collecting DNA?
Absolutely not. And when you think about the D.B. Cooper case, when D.B. Cooper, and we'll talk about how that all played out, but when he was on the flight that he hijacked, he smoked 8 Raleigh filter tip cigarettes. And the best of my knowledge, those cigarettes were destroyed by the FBI, which is really it's really crazy. Obviously, DNA did not exist back in 1971, but the FBI usually does not get rid of any evidence because they understand that that could play a part later in a criminal conviction. You know, just having the fact that, hey, this is our suspect and he's known to smoke this brand of cigarette. Well, prove it. How do you know what D.B. Cooper smoked? You can't prove it now because you threw them away. So it's really strange to me that the FBI would have destroyed the cigarettes, but that's what I understand from another D.B. Cooper researcher named Eric Ullis. He's confident that the cigarettes were destroyed, and that's unfortunate because that would have been the best source of DNA, you know, from D.B. Cooper. So they may have an opportunity, and they've already tried this, to get a DNA sample from microparticles that were found on D.B. Cooper's tie. He left a black tie on the plane after he jumped out of it, and they were able to put this tie under a microscope and extract tiny little particles from it. A group called the Citizen Sleuths were doing that, and they tried to make a DNA profile from those particles, and unfortunately it's just didn't really go anywhere. It did not make a good DNA profile, so they do not have D.B. Cooper's DNA right now. But we're fortunate that something may turn up soon. I mean, I've heard a story about maybe that someone that worked at the FBI took one of the cigarettes home and that might reappear. You know, and there's some things out there like that that maybe we'll get fortunate and something will turn up on them.
Well, to the people out there that doesn't know about the hijacking with the D.B. Cooper, what year did it take place? And can you walk us through what happened? I mean, how did he pull it off?
Absolutely. Well, how it happened was it was a late afternoon on Thanksgiving Eve of 1971. A man wearing business attire carrying an anti-Shea case bought a one-way ticket from Portland, Oregon to Seattle, Washington. He identified himself only as Dan Cooper, and that's the name that the ticket agent for Northwest Orient Airlines wrote down on his ticket. The gentleman boarded Flight 305, and he sat in the back of the plane in seat 18C, which was an aisle seat. So just after takeoff, the man handed a flight attendant a note, and the flight attendant thought the man was hitting on her, so she just stuck the note in her pocket, and he grabbed her by the arm and said, "Miss, I really need you to read that note." And so she opened up the note, and the note said, "Miss, I have a bomb, and I want you to sit by me." So she knew this was serious. Something bad was going on. So she sat next to him, Dan Cooper, as he was calling himself, and he began to tell her his demands. And she would write and started writing his demands down. And the main demands were $200,000 in $20 bills. And he also asked for 4 parachutes. And that's 2 sets of parachutes. He asked for 2 front and 2 back. And that was actually really smart because they were going to believe that he was going to take a hostage with them. Very smart. And he also said when the plane was going to land in Seattle that he wanted a fuel truck there ready to fuel up the plane. So she took the notes up to the cockpit and told him what was going on. Flight was being hijacked, and the cockpit crew immediately called the head people at Northwest Orient Airlines and told them what was going on. And, well, let me go back to something that was really important. He showed her what was inside the attaché case, and that was a bomb. It had what looked like sticks of dynamite with wires, and that was pretty convincing. And she looked at that and felt like, you know, this is serious. This guy means business. So goes up to the cockpit, tells the crew what's going on, and they called Northwest Orient, and they immediately decided to comply with the hijacker's demands. So the plane lands in at SeaTac Airport in Seattle. It parks at a remote part of the runway, you know, far away from where the plane would usually land and let off. And that was smart for D.B. Cooper because he thought there would be snipers there. So he wanted the plane as far away as it could be. The fuel truck shows up, fuels up the plane, and they bring onto the plane his ransom, $200,000, and it came in a bank bag and not a knapsack that he requested. They brought four parachutes, two front and two back. So he let all the passengers, he let them off the plane. They didn't even realize the plane was being hijacked until they got off of the plane and into the airport itself. So he decides to keep some of the flight crew on. Flight takes off from Seattle, and somewhere around the Portland, Oregon area, around Vancouver, Washington, Portland, Oregon area, just over the border, he jumps out of the plane with the money and took the briefcase with him, and he's never seen again. Huge manhunt ensues over days and weeks, months, and not a sign of D.B. Cooper or his money's ever found until February 1980. It was actually February 10th, 1980. An eight-year-old boy named Brian Ingram was at a picnic with his family at a little beach along the Columbia River outside of Vancouver, Washington, called the Tina Bar. And they were going to build a little fire. And the young boy started digging and looking for wood to make this fire. And he dug up three stacks of $20 bills that were stacked on top of each other. And that later turned out to be $5,800 of D.B. Cooper's loot, part of the $200,000. And that was confirmed because all the bills were tracked by serial numbers. So they immediately were able to tell that that was indeed D.B. Cooper's money. The young boy got to keep part of that money after some negotiations. And that's the last anything's ever happened that was big in this case, the part of that money turning up. So that's, you know, the basic story of D.B. Cooper.
Very interesting. Now, when he got on the plane, too, they, what, figured he had a disguise, too, from what he normally would look like?
Yeah, you know, he's wearing this business attire. People assumed that he was a businessman. He was wearing dark sunglasses, so that was all part of the part of his disguise. And you know, this guy was you know, calm as a cucumber, as they say, when he pulled this off, which was just something very rare. And that really drew me into the case was just reading about how calm he was. How could anybody be calm hijacking an airplane and jumping out into not so great weather at night? Because this probably dragged on a little longer than he wanted it to. So it was nighttime at that point, and any kind of skydiving at night is a whole different ball game. Even for experienced skydivers, a lot of recreational skydivers do not have night jumps under their belt, and they're a lot more difficult because you can't have a point of reference on the ground. So this was a difficult jump in anybody's book.
Well, again, too, where he jumped, if I remember right, it was very rugged terrain too. So I mean, you know, again, if somebody wasn't really experienced. I mean, even somebody, even halfway experienced, but not really experienced, the jump Absolutely. Could have been fatal.
Absolutely. He was jumping over the Pacific Northwest, lots of water and lots of trees. And going into the water probably would have been a pretty certain death for most people because, the water was so cold. If he had fallen into the Columbia River, he probably would have frozen to death. And, and then jumping into that dense forest, it's easy to break a leg or an arm or something coming down, hitting the trees. You can't really see at night. So extremely dangerous for anyone.
Oh, yeah. And again, too, if you're out in a dense forest area and you break a leg or anything or even a foot where you can't walk, the odds are surviving is not very good. A lot of hunters go out in the woods. And something happens where they get injured and they succumb to that injury. You know, again, if you're out in the middle of nowhere and you break your leg, what are you going to do? How are you going to get anywhere?
Yeah, that's very, very difficult stuff to be going into with no experience. And, you know, hunters have hunted those areas ever since this happened over, 50 years ago. And they never found any bones. They never found a parachute. Very interesting. If you jump with a parachute, that's pretty visible. And if he died on the way down, he wouldn't exactly been able to have buried it. So never found the parachute, never found the bones. The only thing ever found was that $5,800. They thought they found a placard from that same Flight 305 Boeing 727, and they're not even sure that placard came from that flight. So it's really just the money that was ever found, the $5,800 by Brian Ingram.
Very interesting. We need to take about a two-minute break. We'll be back with Drew Moore. We're going to talk a little bit more about, what he did on that plane and all that stuff. So stay tuned. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio.
Meet the Totally Ninja Raccoons. Three raccoons who become ninjas because they already have the masks. The Totally Ninja Raccoons books are short adventures with quick chapters, specially structured to encourage reluctant readers. Each book has the Totally Ninja Raccoons encountering a cryptid. The monsters are presented in a fun, not-so-scary way.
Hey! I said not-so-scary!
Readers are encouraged to do their own research and make up their own minds about the possible existence of Bigfoot, the Jersey Devil, aliens, and more. The Totally Ninja Raccoons are available on Amazon or at your favorite bookstore. You can buy autographed copies direct from the author at kevincoolidge.org. That's kevincoolidge.org for the Totally Ninja Raccoons. Is your mind really a time machine? Can you change your past, erasing your past mistakes? Can you visit parallel future realities, drawing your goals to you like magic? At Harvard University, brain imaging techniques prove the human brain is a time machine. Astrophysicist Michio Kaku says thinking is really time traveling. A book called Mind, Time, and Power by Anthony Hamilton is loaded with amazing new insights and jam-packed with thought exercises to build your brain like an athlete builds his biceps. It's the new psychology for the 21st century. Get and read Mind, Time, and Power by Anthony Hamilton. Available on Amazon or at mindtimeandpower.com.
I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Night Dreams brings on the night worldwide. Did you know you can find us on your favorite app? And now you can watch us live on YouTube. Make sure you subscribe to our channel and give us a thumbs up. And now, here's Gary.
And here I am. I keep thinking every time he says that Johnny Carson show, when Ed McMahon would say, here's Johnny. But anyway, here, I don't know. Drew, a lot of things was interesting. I think another reason why he requested those extra parachutes, like you mentioned, to make him think that he's going to take hostages and have them jump. The other thing that comes to my mind is that if they're thinking other people are going to jump with them, they're not going to give them a parachute that won't open.
Exactly.
So I know that's what he was probably thinking there.
Yes, very, very smart.
When that happened, I remember the news at the time because, I grew up in the Northwest here in Washington State. I mean, it was in the news for a long period every day, and people were seeing who they thought was D.B. Cooper everywhere.
Yeah, that must have been great. I would have loved to have been around when it happened.
Yeah, I tell you, every news, every night in the news, D.B. Cooper was seen in Longview, Kelso, and all kinds of different places. Again, what do you think? Do you ever sit back and wonder, what your thoughts, what was he trying to accomplish on here? Because if I was going to kidnap people, That's what it was. And then hijack an aircraft, which you know you're going to go away for a long time. Why only $200,000?
That's a good point. You know, that's brought up a lot. You know, part of it is the weight coming down. I mean, if you're weighted too heavy, you can spin out, which is definitely part of it. He probably also knew, you know, a $20 bill back then is similar to a $100 bill now in terms of value.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, there were higher denominations, but that was would have been easier to track. I think that, you know, I think it was pretty well planned. I do think it was money motivated more than just proving a point. I know a lot of people try to argue, well, the government set this up because they wanted to tighten up air, you know, safety on airlines as far as things being hijacked. But I just don't think they would have to have gone to the level of, you know, having a DB Cooper on the plane and doing this, because so many things could have gone wrong. There were air marshals back then. And back in 1971, you could easily carry a gun on a plane. If you had it in a pocket or a bag or a lady's purse, no one was checking your purses back then. This is so far before 9/11. It's hard for people now to even believe that, but it would have been really easy to get a handgun on there. So if things got out of control, or a passenger became aware that it was being hijacked, they could have, you know, tried to intervene, and things could have gotten really messy. So I just personally never really leaned towards this, the government setting this up to tighten the restrictions on flights to prevent more hijackings.
Well, you know, D.B. Cooper could have just basically walked into that, you know, where the pilots were. I mean, the door they had at that time wasn't really secure. I mean, you could have just kicked it right open. It's not like the doors now, you know, going into the cockpit of the planes here in the last 20 years. They made some major changes for that people can't get in. But, I mean, back then it would have been just easy to, you know, taken over the plane no matter what. Again, you know, do you have feelings who this guy could have been? And if so, what was his past? What did he do?
Well, I've always, you know, of course, that's the thing for me. I had to know who this guy was. I mean, for, like I said, to satisfy myself to the most extent who it was, because I just became so enchanted by the story when I first heard about it on a TV show called In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy in 1979. Just became fascinated with it. I never thought I'd research, you know, do a whole lot of research or even write a book about it, but I just always wondered who would this guy be. And I always felt that the guy was military. I just did. I mean, for so many reasons, I just had that feeling. It just, to me, sounded like something a military guy would do. More specifically, a guy that was in special forces in Vietnam. That was during the Vietnam era. And it sounded like something a special forces guy would do. And be someone that could pull it off and remain calm and have the skills to do it. So I was always of the belief that this guy was special forces and spent time in Vietnam. And, you know, I always knew the descriptions of D.B. Cooper all said that he was middle-aged. So I thought that's kind of odd. You know, if he was in Vietnam, the average age of the fighting man was 19 years old. Oh, yeah. Special forces guys were a little bit older, around 23, you know, because they had more training. But I just knew that if I ever ran across anybody that was special forces, that was middle-aged but still active, that would probably be a good place to look. And lo and behold, I found somebody that fit that mold. And that's, you know, that's after I had a really good understanding of all the known suspects in the case and knew all their backgrounds. I was really interested in a suspect named William Gossett, who later changed his name to Wolfgang, and was being investigated by an attorney from Seattle named Galen Cook. Would go on to Coast to Coast AM radio talking about his suspect William Gossett, and then I became really interested in William Gossett and thought this could be the guy, because Galen Cook was such a great researcher and you know, real well-spoken, and you know, that's the guy that Coast to Coast liked to have on. Big Coast to Coast fan, of course, back from the Art Bell days, and really became interested in him. And then later a documentary came out about another suspect who was in Vietnam by the name of Robert Wesley Rackstraw. So became interested in him. They had a big TV show about him called D.B. Cooper Case Closed on the History Channel. And I remember watching that show thinking, I hope they solved it, because I really want to know who did it. And they start making this great case for this helicopter pilot from Vietnam named Robert Rackstraw. And then by the end of the show, it just completely derails, fizzles out. They had Tina Mucklow, who was the flight attendant that spent the most time with D.B. Cooper, looked at a full table of photographs of Robert Rackstraw, and she looked at him and said, "This isn't him. Sorry, guys. I know you want me to say it's him, but I can't. This is not the man that I sat by for 2.5 hours during this hijacking." So that was really a huge blow to these people that spent so much time and money pushing for Robert Rackstraw. So I was kind of deflated. I was hoping they solved it. And I was reading a D.B. Cooper message board one day, which I never really participated in much, but I did like to read them. This one was called the D.B. Cooper Forum. There's actually two, the D.B. Cooper Forum and another one called the Drop Zone. And a guy named Bruce Smith, who's considered the mayor of Cooperville because he's been following this case for so long, and another commenter went under the name Snowman. We're talking about this ex-Special Forces guy named Ted B. Braden. And he was part of an elite special forces unit that I had never heard of. It was the Black Ops unit in Vietnam called MACV-SOG, and that stands for Military Assistance Command Vietnam Studies and Observations Group. Really benign sounding name, but these guys are the toughest of the tough that were over in Vietnam doing all the covert stuff. They were mostly over in Laos, which they called Across the Fence, because we weren't supposed to be in Laos. Because of the Geneva Accords, and that's what these guys were doing. They were sent into Laos to slow down the movement of the North Vietnamese down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So when they went in there, they had to be what they call completely sterile. You couldn't have dog tags. You couldn't have anything identifying yourself, who you were. If you were American, you had to have your clothing, nothing to identify that you could be American, because we weren't supposed to be over there. But we were sending these teams in. But they were called strike teams or recon teams. You would either be ST or RT, and they were named after states in the United States. And Ted Braden was on a team called RT Colorado. And these teams were made up of 7 men, 3 would be Americans, and the team leader was called the 1-0. And Ted Braden was the 1-0 of Team Colorado. And the 3 Americans and the other members balancing out a team were called indigenous fighters or mountain yards, which were an ethnic tribal group in the area that the U.S. Special Forces would train, and they made really good soldiers. So they made balanced out a 7-man team. So Braden gets over to Vietnam in 1965, and he's a member of MACV-SOG, and his team is doing prisoner snatches. Braden's team did the first successful wiretap in Laos, where they hooked up a machine and got North Vietnamese intelligence recorded onto tape, and they found locations of a general. Really hardcore stuff. And when these guys hit the ground over there, they were hunted immediately. The North Vietnamese knew they were coming in. Sometimes they were tipped off when these teams would come over there into Laos, and they were being hunted immediately. They were doing daring skydiving jumps at night into really hostile territory. So there's no better training to later become the guy that jumped out of a plane in 1971. And this is just a small part of Ted Braden's military history, was being the team leader for Team Colorado as part of MACV-SOG. So I was just blown away by even finding out about not only Ted Braden, but this whole thing called SOG in Vietnam, and I just became fascinated with it.
Oh, there was a lot of stuff on in Vietnam. People would be totally shocked if they found out and even knew about to this day. I mean, there were so many different special ops going on in Cambodia and Thailand and all those areas. Again, on this guy, were you able to trace more of his history going back before his military or anything?
Yeah, I traced his whole life. I was very fortunate to do so. So, they had some information about him on those message boards, and it was just enough for me to get started because I had to know who this guy was. And, so I found out, his whole life story. He was born in 1928 in Toledo, Ohio. He signed up to join to go fight in World War II. He lied about his age. He was 16 years old at the time, and he got an aunt to go lie for him. So he joins, and he becomes a member of the 101st Airborne, the Screaming Eagles, and he does his training at in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And then he gets shipped off at 16 years old to go fight in World War II and saw combat. It's still at age 16. He's in the Battle of the Bulge. He's doing, he's jumping out of planes. He's already a paratrooper at that young age. Already seeing hard combat. So he finishes up World War II, takes a boat back over to the United States. He goes to college for 2 years at Toledo College. And then, you know, he's already found out what his calling is, and that's being in the military. And that he's already found out that he's really good at something, you know, just jumping out of an airplane. And he winds up joining the Air Force for a while. That doesn't last. He gets back into the Army, and he's a skydiving instructor at Fort Benning for a while. And then he finds himself in the early 1960s in the Army, and he's in a military jumping club called the Golden Arrows. And he's competing in skydiving competitions as a member of the Army all over Europe. And he wins most of these. I mean, he's in France, he's in Scotland, and, you know, there's big trophies given out because he's so good at skydiving that he just knows that's his calling, is jumping out of an airplane. He's just that good at it. And, you know, he spends 2 years over in Germany, and then he finds his way over to Vietnam in early 1965 as a member of MACV SOG. And he's originally brought over there to train other Special Forces members that were part of something called Project Delta, and how to do something called HALO skydiving. And that stands for high altitude, low opening, where you would, you know, be jumping from really high altitudes, not to be detected, and pulling your ripcord at really, really low levels, which is really dangerous stuff. But Ted Braden was a pioneer of that. He loved being in Vietnam because there was really no restrictions on jumping. One of his favorite things to do was to pull the ripcord under 1,000 feet, which is suicide for most people, but he loved doing that. He loved pushing the envelope. And it's said of him that he had a secret death wish that was coupled with amazing survival instincts. Because he could just push the envelope of death, but always come out alive. And that's what he did with his team in Vietnam, Team Colorado. He would walk on open trails over in Laos, which was an extreme no-no, because the NVA would know where you were walking. If you were on open trail, they could track you and kill everybody in your unit. And really, they wouldn't, you know, if they could capture you alive, that's what they wanted to do, because they would torture you first. And but he didn't care. He'd walk on an open trail. He had the first night vision device in Vietnam. It was called a starlight scope. And that was given to Braden because he had so many CIA contacts over in Vietnam. They gave him this thing called a starlight scope, where you know, which was basically night vision back then in 1965. And it wasn't working properly. So there's a story about where he just got mad about it and threw it down and smashed it on a rock. Pieces everywhere. You just don't do that, because if the people tracking you find that, they're going to know what direction you went. But he just didn't care. He was one of these guys that just said, you know, just wasn't scared of death.
It sounds like it. I mean, so, you know, he has all this background. How about relationship-wise? Was he married? Did he have any children or anything like that?
He was married 3 times. And a really interesting thing about that is he was with his third wife. He had 3 stepdaughters, and I was able to talk at length with this youngest stepdaughter. And, you know, she was kind of reluctant to even talk to me at first, until I told her something that caught her attention. I was sending her messages through Facebook, and I said, "Did you know that Ted Braden had 2 biological children? And she wrote me back. She said, "Really?" Like, question mark. She had no idea that he had 2 biological children. This is his stepdaughter that he lived with for years. And she had no idea. So this guy can keep a secret. One of his best friends, a guy that I knew really well, who unfortunately passed away a few months ago, his name was Ted's jumping partner from the Golden Arrows, a gentleman named Al Tyre. He had no idea that Ted Braden had 2 biological children. He was blown away by that, literally, because he goes, "Man, I knew this guy well." You know, he knew his second wife, a lady named Patricia, and he would stay with them during the holidays. He was with them in Germany for 2 years, very close to Ted Braden and Pat. And he said, "I had no idea. He never told me he had 2 children. So he could keep a secret, you know, very, very secretive guy.
Very interesting. What type of person was he with friends and stuff? Was he easygoing, or was he, again, did he have this type of personality that he didn't care if something happened?
You know, to his friends, he was really well liked. His words were always measured. He did not cuss. Everything that came out of his mouth, he would always hesitate before he spoke, because he always wanted to choose the right words. He was very self-conscious about his appearance. He was always wearing a coat or a tie or a sweater, and he often smoked a pipe. He did smoke cigarettes, which is important because we know who else smoked cigarettes on that plane, but Ted Braden often smoked a pipe because it was sophisticated, and he wanted to be seen as a sophisticated person. And people would said of him, if you saw him when he wasn't in his regular, you know, army clothes, you would think that he was either a colonel or a professor, was what they said of Ted Braden. He was just very fastidious about his appearance. He did push-ups every morning on a flatboard. He did sit-ups all day. He was very fit as a you know, middle-aged guy. When he got over to Vietnam, he was 34. And at the time of the T.B. Cooper skyjacking, he was 43. Very fit guy. You know, his friends liked him. He did have a violent side, though. You know, he'd been in a lot of combat. He probably suffered from PTSD. You know, that people really didn't know what that was then, but I think he did have some level of mental illness, and he was very distant. His assistant team leader over in Vietnam was a guy named Jim Hetrick, and Jim told me that, you know, it took him, Jim, a long time to even forgive Ted Braden because he almost got him killed so many times and he couldn't believe it, you know, so he did develop a hatred for the man, but later he decided to forgive him because he just knew this was just a really screwed up war we're in. And he remembers, Ted Braden would be drinking at a bar in Saigon or something like that, and or after a mission, and Jim would try to go talk to him and get him to know him better, and he just said you just couldn't. He was just so distant that you couldn't even really get to know him on a deeper level.
Interesting. Why do you feel he is the one that actually was D.B. Cooper?
The main thing that really pointed me in that direction first was we talk about MACV-SOG, and MACV-SOG was classified. When you joined to be a member of MACV-SOG over in Vietnam, they would say, you'll either receive one or two things, a body bag or a Purple Heart, because the casualty rate was 100% in SOG. It was literally a suicide mission to even sign up to be in this group, and it was completely classified. When you joined up, they said you cannot tell anybody about this for 20 years. Not your wife, not your girlfriend. Even when you're done and go back to the United States, you cannot talk about it for 20 years. That's the time limit they set on it. So after the 20 years was over, these men that were in this elite unit could talk about it. And then, you know, some books eventually came out. One, a guy named John Stryker Meyer would write one called Across the Fence. And now people started learning about this Black Ops unit in Vietnam, became very popular. So, of course, when SOG became declassified, people would ask them that thought about it, like, hey, you know, was there anybody among you that could have been D.B. Cooper? And there's only one name that ever came forward, and that was Ted Braden. There was never a second name. And among these people that were saying it were legends of Special Forces in Vietnam. One of them is a guy named John Plaster. And this guy is just up there. You know, he's just absolute Special Forces legend, well-known. And he was asked, who do you think D.B. Cooper was? And he said, Ted Braden. Another guy was a guy named Billy Waugh. I mean, Billy Waugh is probably the most revered person to ever been in Special Forces. He had a 40-year career between Special Forces and working for the CIA. He had a book called Hunt for the Jackal. He tracked Bin Laden. When he was in his 60s, he tracked down Bin Laden and actually could have taken a shot and probably taken him out, but he was told not to. Billy Waugh is one of the top Special Forces legends of all time, and he was asked multiple times, do you think Ted Braden could have been D.B. Cooper? And he said yes and absolutely did not dismiss it. So these legends in Special Forces were all pointing to Ted Braden, and that's when I locked into him. I was like, I got to know more about this guy. And why they believe that. And countless others said the same thing. A guy named Jason Hardy writes these books about MACV-SOG. These big, colorful books, all these rare photographs that he collected. He interviewed many soldiers from MACV-SOG, and he was he's into the D.B. Cooper case, and he asked multiple guys, who do you think D.B. Cooper was? And they always said Ted Braden. They never gave a second name, even out of SOG, which were about 1,300 guys. I mean, these guys were all the most elite. They all knew how to jump out of planes at night, all new survival techniques, and not a second name comes forward. That really intrigued me. Why wouldn't, among you, the best ever, why wouldn't another name come up? And then another thing that points you to something like MACV-SOG with D.B. Cooper is D.B. Cooper knew that you could jump the aft stair of a Boeing 727. And that was not widely known in 1971 that plane could be jumped like that. because the aft stair was in the middle of the plane where passengers could board or get off the plane. But only people that were doing covert missions over in Vietnam would have had that knowledge. Even the pilots didn't know that. And another thing that happened was when D.B. Cooper hijacked the plane and it landed in Seattle, he wanted it to take off from Seattle with the aft stair and the down position. And you know why? Because he knew he was going to jump out of it. And he didn't want to worry about that aft stair having to be released, you know, in flight. He felt more comfortable knowing the stair was already down, and he knew the plane could take off from the ground with that stair down. The pilots didn't even know this. Cooper did, and he argued for it.
Drew, wouldn't that also keep the plane where it couldn't go to a certain speed? They would have to fly it at a slower speed with that down, if I remember right?
Yes, could be. That could have been another reason why he wanted it down. And the pilots absolutely refused, and it was a point of contention. And Cooper finally relented and said you could take off with the stair up, because the pilots literally thought the plane would probably come apart if the plane took off with that stair down. But Cooper knew it could take off with the stair down because he had that knowledge. And someone in MACV SOG would have known that from covert jumps that had been done in Thailand. And that's just something they were doing with Air America over in Vietnam. So that's another thing that really points to a Special Forces guy that had that knowledge.
Well, it sounds like he had the knowledge because, you know, I remember at the time they were doing even tests. The FBI, you know, Boeing aircraft and, you know, FAA and a whole bunch of different organizations were doing tests that if the plane could even fly with it down in all that stuff. So it was, this guy evidently knew the capabilities. Like I said, again, having the parachutes brought on, people thinking, you know, that he's going to have people jump out with him so they wouldn't give him a faulty parachute. Everything. I mean, it was very well thought out. It wasn't something like, you know, tomorrow I'm going to hijack a plane and ask for $200,000.
It was very well planned. That's why it looks so much like Special Forces. It was highly intelligent. Using a briefcase bomb was a game changer. The FBI even said that at the time. It was a game changer. It was very well thought out, which brings you back to Ted Braden. He had what they call a general technical score in the Army of 150, and that's kind of an indicator of IQ. That would be one of the highest GT scores you could get. He was highly intelligent. His own sister-in-law said of him that he was the perfect combination of high intelligence and criminality. Now, Ted Braden was a criminal, and we'll get to that. But another thing that really first intrigued me that I read first before I met a gentleman, his name is Hank Birch. And the quick story of it is Ted Braden's over at Vietnam. He's over there for 23 months straight. That's an endurance record, doing, you know, heavy combat. And at some point at the end of 1966 in December, he's in a bar in Saigon, and he hears that mercenaries are being paid really good money to go fight in the Congo Wars. And he's thinking, you know, I want money. You know, I'm really a really good soldier. I'm not making much as a sergeant first class. So I'm just gonna leave Vietnam and go fight in the Congo. So he just takes it upon himself just to leave Vietnam. Doesn't tell anybody. He just leaves. This is all true. It's the craziest story you've ever heard. So I'm like, okay. So he goes back to the United States, and as he says it, his whole story is told by himself in a 1967. Magazine called Rampart, which is just great that his story's there and that he got to tell it. It was published in a magazine. It's just so fortunate. And he tells this story. So he gets over to the United States over Christmas. And so it's early January now of 1967. He makes his way over to London, and then he makes his way over to Belgium. And he's in Brussels because he's heard that there's a hotel in Brussels, Belgium, where they're hiring mercenaries to go fight down in the Congo. And he tells the story of how he meets up with these crazy characters, and he winds up finding the right recruiter, and he winds up becoming a member of Five Commando, which is Mad Mike Hoare's unit, famous unit down in the Congo Wars. So he's down in the Congo, and he's under an alias of a Canadian guy who was killed prematurely in a mortar attack in Special Forces of Vietnam. So Ted Braden's using the name of Canadian as an alias. Which is funny because people speculate that D.B. Cooper actually, you know, when he hijacked that plane, he gave the name Dan Cooper. D.B. Cooper is just a media screw up because they found somebody's name over the AP. It got overheard, and someone accidentally wrote down D.B. Cooper, and that's how the name just stuck. So, but that's not the name he used. He used the name Dan Cooper. But people thought that he took that name from a Belgian comic book about a Canadian fighter pilot, you know, fictitious, of course, but went by the name Dan Cooper. So it's funny that Ted Braden took the name of an alias of a dead Canadian from Special Forces and signs up to fight in Five Commando under that name because he knows, you know, he's trying to hide out from the CIA. He's already went AWOL from Vietnam. So he's over fighting in the Congo. He gets into the unit. They quickly figure out this guy. He's fighting for this guy named Colonel Ralph Peters. And they quickly ascertained that this guy has the stuff. I mean, he's got every skill you could ever want in a mercenary, weapons, you name it. I mean, he quickly demonstrates to them that that he knows what he's doing. He never sees any combat over in Five Commando because somebody tips off the CIA that there's an American down here fighting with us. So his Colonel Ralph Peters, lures him to a hotel in the Congo. And he tells Ted Braden he needs to talk to him. And they walk him down to the end of a hallway, and they get near a door, and then all of a sudden, four men come out of the shadows, and they're all pointing guns at Ted Braden's head, and they said, "Are you Ted B. Braden?" And he's like, "I guess you caught me, you know, yeah."
Now, hey, Drew, we need to take a break. This break's about 4.5 minutes long. We'll be back to wrap this up with Drew, so you're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio. Just some sad news we just got. One of our regular guests, John Lear, passed away here today, and I thought I'd share that to all the listeners. And he was a great guest, a lot of good stories, you know, and I was planning to have him back on, but I know he's been in ill health lately. And again, my condolences to his family, his daughter. Again, John Lear just passed away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio.
If I have a soul, soul. If the ice is cold. If I last forever. If I'm your man. If the time is over. If the night is my cover. If the life is to suffer. Now you go. I'm lost.
Did you know Night Dreams Talk Radio now has a great store? And now's the time to get that Night Dreamer, that cool Night Dreams tee, or Bigfoot mug. Night Dream Store has lots of awesome items to pick from, all for the Night Dreamer. For details, check out our show's website at www.nightdreamstalkradio.com. Echoes of Eden by Paul Wallace. What secrets of human potential lie hidden in the world's ancestral narratives? How are they connected with God, the Bible, and ET contact? From U.S. Senate briefings to ancient African ceremonies, from strange phenomena in Australia and Iraq to anomalies in Brazil and ancient Greece, the Eden series takes you around the world to discover why governments, military, and intelligence are interested in archaeology and initiation practices, and why you should be too. And what are the implications for you and me? To buy Echoes of Eden, The Scars of Eden, and Escaping from Eden, go to Amazon, Kindle, Barnes & Noble, and wherever books are sold. Echoes of Eden is endorsed by George Noory. Paul has done it again with his Eden series, delving deep into the power of the mind to do incredible things. Are you searching for deeper answers when it comes to experiences with the Sasquatch and other cryptids? One man who seems to be taking that deeper dive is Ron Moorhead. His incredibly clear, scientifically vetted Bigfoot Sierra sounds will send shivers. In addition to these recordings, he's written two books, Voices in the Wilderness, which is the chronicle of interactions that went on for years up in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and then his latest, The Quantum Bigfoot, where he bravely goes where others fear and takes it head-on, again backed by science. The disappearing tracks, the pixelated images, and the screams in the dark. All of this and more can be found at ronmoorhead.com. That's www.ronmoorhead.com. Are you into the paranormal? Then you have found the right place. Night Dreams covers the topics you want to hear. And Gary always has a great guest to take you for a real ride in talk radio. So, buckle up and let's go for that ride with Gary.
And we are back. Hey, Drew, we got a couple minutes left before we have to wrap it up. I got to ask you a question. So everything does point to this guy, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, after that, just real quick, he was put in confinement at Fort Dix for desertion. And that's when a guy named Colonel Hank Birch, he's retired lieutenant colonel, was a captain at the time, encountered Ted Braden. And he was in a cell in Fort Dix, New Jersey, and he quickly was drawn to Hank's attention because Ted Braden had a TV in his jail cell. He had cigars with filters on them in jail. And this is completely unheard of. You weren't allowed to have filters because the prisoners would stop up toilets with them. And you were absolutely not supposed to have a color TV or a TV, but at Fort Dix as a prisoner for desertion. And this is crazy. So, Braden told Hank one day, you know, because he was the supervisor over him as a prisoner. He said, "Don't worry, sir. This is all going to work out." Braden knew that somebody was going to protect him. So it came the day for Ted Braden's court-martial there at Fort Dix. And an hour or so before this court-martial was going to happen, a man named Harold K. Johnson called over to Fort Dix. And this guy was the top guy over the entire U.S. Army. The only person higher than Harold K. Johnson at the time was the president of the United States. He was the chief of staff of the U.S. Army was his title. And he called intervening on Ted Braden's behalf. And he said, "We're not going to have Ted Braden's court-martial today." And they said, "Why?" And he said, "There's not enough MPs on the base to secure the courtroom." And Hank said, "Are you kidding me? This is Fort Dix. This place is crawling with MPs." It was just a contrived excuse not to have the court-martial. So they wound up giving Ted Braden a general discharge from the military after desertion. And Braden balks at this because he wants his special wristwatch back. This is unheard of. This is a completely true story. I know Hank Birch. He even has the stories recorded on a podcast that I did. This has never happened before. You desert from the battlefield and you get a general discharge, and he even balked at that. And Ted Braden had to promise never to join the military again. So he shows up later, Ramparts Magazine. So there's so many things that point to Ted Braden. And one of the main things that I point to, it's just one of many, is a letter that was written that was sent in by someone claiming to be D.B. Cooper. There were six letters sent in from people claiming to be D. Cooper. A lot of them were all signed D.B. Cooper. And I never felt that D.B. Cooper would use the name D.B. Cooper because, of course, it was always Dan Cooper. So a letter showed up to the Portland, Oregonian newspaper on March 28, 1972. So this is just a few months after the hijacking. And it reads, just a short, it reads this. Gentlemen, this letter is to let you know that I am not dead, but really alive, and just back from the Bahamas. So your silly troopers up there can stop looking for me. That's just how dumb this government is. I'd like your articles about me, but you can stop them now. D.B. Cooper is not real. I had to do something with the experience Uncle taught me. So here I am, a very rich man. Uncle gave too much of it to world idiots and no work for me. I had to do it to relieve myself of frustration. I went out of the system and saw a way through good old Unc. Now you know I am going around the world and they will never find me because I am smarter than the system's lackey cops and lame duck leaders. Now it's Uncle's turn to weep and pay one of its own some cash for a change. And please tell the lackey cops D.B. Cooper is not my real name. Sincerely, a rich man. So that letter really stuck out to me because the first five, as I said, were all kind of cryptic. Some were cut out. Pieces of letters from Playboy magazine. They were all signed D.B. Cooper. This one was not. It says D.B. Cooper is not real. It's not my real name. And it says the experience that Uncle taught me. Well, that's obviously he's talking about the military. The military trained him to be somebody that would have the ability to jump out of a Boeing 727 and come up with this caper in the first place. And fortunately, you know, having the Ramparts magazine article in the part written by Ted Braden, we know that this is how he spoke. And shortening Uncle Sam to Uncle or Unc is not normal. Usually when you refer to Uncle Sam, it's just Uncle Sam, right? So this is the last paragraph Ted Braden wrote in 1967 in Ramparts magazine. He says this, "I need work, and I don't mean driving somebody's truck. There is a great need for people with my talents, but unfortunately, the CIA is doing the hiring or the others. Because of the CIA, lack the funds to make a contract interesting. Evidently, I'm on the agency's blacklist, and that makes it difficult to contract other employers from this country. Those who can use my help in Latin America are trying to fight using indigenous and foreign idealists, which means no money for the professionals. It's too bad Snowser, Rojas, and Somoza are in so tight with," and this is in quotes, "Sam." He's condensing Uncle Sam to just Sam. "Otherwise, they would pay well. I'd like to go back to the Congo, but I don't think they'll let me. Too bad, because the anti-Motubu boys are making a bundle." So there's more in that Ramparts magazine that reads just like this letter. The military trained him to be able to have these extreme talents. And it's like he says in the letter, "I had to do something with the experience Uncle taught me." Well, they taught Ted Braden to be the best skydiver that probably ever lived. The guy had 900 log free falls. He could have done the D.B. Cooper jump blindfolded, drunk, and hung upside down. And he would have been one of the only people on the earth that could have done pulled that whole thing off and not been scared. He also knew that if he did get caught, that they were going to have to let him go because he had so much dirt on the CIA for being a CIA contractor, because CIA ran Magnusog in Vietnam.
Oh yeah, they did.
He knew all the dirty stuff in Vietnam, and not just that. I learned about him. He knew stuff that they were doing globally. So, and he had friends in high places like Jack Singlob, a famous general that founded the CIA, World War II guy that Ted Braden knew. Is a member of the Golden Arrows because Singlob used to come by the jump club in Germany and knew Braden from there. And then later, Jack Singlob becomes the chief of MacVSOG in 1966. And interesting enough, too, Billy Waugh that I mentioned earlier that fully believed Ted Braden was D.B. Cooper was Jack Singlob's right-hand man in Vietnam. So these guys knew who Cooper was. Singlob, like I said, co-founded the CIA. He knew everything. He was Braden's friend. He could have got him out of trouble. He's probably what got him out of Fort Dix in confinement. Braden knew that if he got caught for this, they were going to have to let him go. And I truly believe they always knew that it was him.
Well, it sure sounds like it's him. You know, FBI here just recently, 2 weeks ago, I think, there was an article in the news that they're narrowing it down, you know, finally. And maybe they're going to announce who they think it was. And you know what? That would maybe be closure. Well, Drew, how long did it take you to write this book?
You know, it took about, unfortunately, I had a really good editor that put a lot in you know, this jumbled mess into a readable form. But it took about 6 months, and it's a pretty lengthy book because it's a lot about Ted Braden's life as a young boy, and then we get into the Cooper stuff. And at the time that I wrote it, you know, I thought there was a pretty good chance that Ted Braden could be D.B. Cooper, and the book's about 2 years old now. And I'd say now I'm far more confident that he was Cooper than when I wrote the book for a lot of reasons.
Well, it sure sounds like it from what you described. And, you know, again, it was – you mentioned, you know, one of the people that it was claiming – it was either in Battleground or Kelso was claiming to be, you know, D.B. Cooper. It was one in Bonnie Lake, believe it or not. I mean, a lot of people were claiming they were D.B. Cooper because they wanted their couple minutes of fame. And to, you know, I don't know. Very interesting whole everything about it. And maybe one day this will be cleared up. Where can they find your book, Drew?
They can find it on Amazon.com. It's called Paratrooper of Fortune, The Story of Ted B. Braden.
Now, do you have a website or anything you can share?
Yes, there's a website. My website is called drewbeesonbooks.com. And I also have a YouTube channel that's just my name, Drew Beeson. And I do a lot of D.B. Cooper stuff, of course. The Yuba County 5 case, which is very interesting, about five men that went missing in the Plumas National Forest in 1978. And, of course, a lot of Zodiac Killer stuff.
Okay, well, maybe we need to get you back on the Zodiac Killer case, because that would be a great subject. Hey, Drew, I want to thank you so much for coming on, my friend.
Sure, thank you. Really enjoyed it.
Okay, my friend, you take care.
You too.
Well, again, we lost somebody that was a mainstay, John Lear, passed away here today. And, you know, how can I say it? I mean, I really didn't know John Lear that well. You know, it took me and my producer a couple years to get John on the show. And then after he was interviewed, he actually really liked the show a lot. He was a great friend of Art Bell. And if he never connected with Art Bell, there would have been no Art Bell show. You know, in the paranormal and conspiracy, it would have never happened. Art Bell was doing, you know, talk radio, talking political, talking about politics. And John Lear, you know, went to the studio and said, you know what, Art, I got an idea. I got an idea how we can take you worldwide, nationally, and all this stuff. And he explained to, you know, Art, you need to talk about the paranormal. You need to talk about UFOs and stuff like that. And Art, you know, told me he thought about it for a few minutes, and he goes, you know, you're right. And it was a big change for Art because, you know, again, he was noted for doing political and stuff out of Las Vegas and other stations, and he made that move. And without the, you know, Art Bell show being paranormal, you know, we wouldn't have all these paranormal talk shows out there. And it all, if you think about it, it was all because John Lear hit up Art Bell and convinced Art Bell he should talk about conspiracies and talk about the strangeness and stuff like that. And, you know, John Lear had really felt really, really, now you can jump in here, James, he felt that we never went to the moon, that it was a hoax, and he had his own theory about it. Now, a little bit about the background of John Lear. His father is the one who created the Lear Jet. He had a falling out with his father and never got involved with, you know, building and marketing the Lear Jets. He went on his own. He flew like 60-some different aircraft in his flight career. He also was connected with the CIA. Am I right on that, James?
Oh, yeah. He flew for the CIA several different missions. He also held, I think 15 or a lot of speed records and a lot of different aerial records. As a matter of fact, he was a legend in the aerial flight field. And he did. He flew, I think, 168 different planes and stuff. He flew a lot of stuff. He was really a pioneer in the area, in the field of flight, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, he's the one that originally told Art Bell, when you die, don't go to the light. It's a trick. Go towards the darkness. Now, I asked him on the last time he was on our show back a couple months ago, and he said, you know, he revised that. He said the person that gave him that information didn't know what they're talking about. He said, you want to go to the light. You don't want to go to through the darkness. And, you know, he had Art Bell so nervous about that for so many years. I remember talking to Art Bell on the phone, and he goes, you know, if anything ever happened to me, I don't know. It really, he was obsessed with it. He didn't know which way to go. Hopefully he went to the light. Trust me. You know, if he went to the darkness, you know, who knows where Art is at right now. But again, I can't believe that John Lear passed. I know he was having a lot of health issues. His daughter was taking care of him. But, you know, it seemed like the last couple of times we talked to him, he was sharp as ever. And, you know, that, and in his personality was back like John Lear was.
Yeah, and I, of course, I'd talked to him a few times to get him on the show, and thankful that he did come on the show. And I will say this, too, on our show, he did kind of recant, wish he hadn't have told Art Bell, you know, not to go to the light. So he did say that, too, on the show. And I got to tell you, I remember seeing John way back 30-plus years ago on many different documentaries, and boy, it was amazing the stuff that I've learned over the years just from him alone. And now that I look back at it, and you're right. If it wasn't for him, Art Bell wouldn't. It was like a whole domino effect with Art Bell and then all these other people, you included.
Yeah, I wouldn't be doing the paranormal, and nobody else would be hardly doing the paranormal. He made paranormal a household name, UFOs a household name, and all that stuff. Now, I'm going to share one story. I know my regular listeners know it, but John Lear did at near Area 51. They went out to the desert. Now, this is many years ago. And he liked getting, you know, kind of rowdy at one point in his life, like real rowdy. And what they did is he rented a Enterprise rent-a-car. And he drove out there. He also had a friend that had a helicopter. And they had a 50 caliber machine gun. And, you know, and then they had some explosives and all that stuff. Well, they decided they were going to take this rental car from Enterprise, and they're going to shoot at it with a 50 caliber. Now, can you imagine a 50 caliber is going to go one through like one side of the car and come out the other side? And they literally shot hundreds of rounds through the car. I mean, the car was like Swiss cheese. They even shot it from above in the helicopter, and what the story was. And here's the thing, after their party was over, after they were done probably with all the booze, they couldn't drive the car back, so they had to put it on a flatbed and take it back to Enterprise. And you can imagine, when you rent a car, you have to sign this waiver, they look at, when you return a car, if there's a teeny weeny scratch on the car, they're going to nail you for it. You're going to pay for it. They also look at the gas gauge. I mean, if you're down, just a little bit, they charge you and gouge you. Could you imagine, think about this, James, the guy who went out there with that clipboard to check out that car, I bet he shit his drawers.
I could just see him giving that car a once over. He must have about passed out with that clipboard. Like, there wasn't enough empty blanks to check on that piece of paper, on that clipboard. My goodness. And it's funny, that whole scenario of him shooting that with that 50 millimeter or caliber out of that helicopter, because those bullets, they're called tank busters. They go through one side of the tank and out the other. So, you know, there wasn't much left of that car. My goodness, it had to be pure shrapnel, you know?
Oh, it would have been. And can you imagine the guys out there, the clipboard, and the guy's freaking out. The car's full of nothing but holes. And the guy says to John Lear, this is the story, is, what happened to the car? And John Lear, with his straight look, looked at him and he says, well, this is what happens when you park a car in the wrong place in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Yep, that's right. And it's funny, that story came to fruition through somebody that was there firsthand, too, that had witnessed that. He was like, they couldn't believe what happened. Because it shocked everybody. It was like a little gathering they do once a year out there in the desert, you know, some kind of convention or they get together, UFO kind of thing. And out of nowhere comes this helicopter and just, you know, they said, clear away. And next thing you know,
yeah, 50 caliber.
Sparks fly.
Yeah, what's left of the car? Swiss cheese, nothing much. Well, everybody, I'm jumping out of here. I will be back on Monday. Normally, we're not on Mondays anymore, but I got a great guest on Monday, and I wanted him to be heard. I'm going to be off for a couple of days, getting well for a change. And no, it's not nothing to do with COVID. It's just, you know, when you get older, you get health issues, and I'm going to take care of it. I want to be around a few more years. So everybody, you take care. Again, make sure you hit the thumbs up. Share us with your friends. Tell your friends about our show. And everybody, have a good one. We'll catch you on the other side of the campground. Everybody, take care.
My heart is yours. Now and forever, never was full before. Then I saw you just like a